Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Before I start the program, I should give you a heads up. Today, 10/15, 2015, at 10:15 a.m., is the Great Oregon Shakeout, which means it begins exactly 15 minutes after the end of this weekly Thursday morning rant. Steve Card, who is editorial page editor of the Newport News Times, gave readers a pretty good idea of what this drill is all about and more. It's a grim preview to help prepare us in mind and spirit for what to do when the mighty quake starts its rock and roll any time in the future, followed virtually instantly by a giant tsunami that will most likely tumble wash the debris our lives will have suddenly become. Eleanor Roosevelt had a few cogent words to say about all this. What one has to do can usually be done. Steve Card, slightly abridged. On this day and at this time, 10:15 at 10:15, students and staff at schools in Lincoln County will drop, cover, and hold on for 60 seconds, practicing what they need to do when an earthquake hits. But it isn't just happening here or even statewide. In fact, according to the website shakeout.org, more than 20.4 million participants have been registered to participate in Great Shakeout earthquake drills across the United States and around the world. This high level of participation is quite likely a result of people becoming more aware of the widespread destruction that comes with a major earthquake, and for those of us along the coast, a resulting tsunami. Coverage through both traditional and social media has clearly shown the devastation wrought by recent catastrophic events. Even if you choose not to drop, cover, and hold on during the Great Oregon Shakeout, it would be an excellent time to look around at work and at home to identify potential earthquake hazards. Things like tall bookcases should be securely attached to the wall, and heavy objects should not be stored on high shelves because during the earthquake, things will fall off. Pictures over a bed can be a particular danger. Sue Graves, safety coordinator for the Lincoln County School District, said it is important to do as much as possible to limit the potential for injuries because if someone is hurt during a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, there's not going to be anything other than just basic medical treatment from people certified in first aid, she said. We're not going to have access to hospitals. The roads will be blocked. Talking about it is one thing, but getting started is key. As one person pointed out, it is better to do it little by little than not at all. A website containing information and other resources relevant to this earthquake drill can be found at www.shakeout.org/Oregon. And for a variety of information and suggestions on how to improve the type of personal resiliency being recommended when the quake strikes, people can go online at www.ready.gov. Well, this morning I'd like to read something about Dorothy Day. So I guess I should give a bit of a disclaimer because the prologue to what she wrote is my opinion and my opinion only, perhaps, in all of the cosmos. Pope Francis I spoke of Dorothy Day when he addressed Congress on his recent visit to the USA. He invoked her as one of four American heroes, and that's in quotes, to be emulated. Yet he had a chance to canonize her as a Catholic saint this past year, but chose not to. She was an American Catholic woman devoted to being with the poor. She was also an avowed socialist and co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She was contemporary to another remarkable and definitely heroic American woman, whom the Pope did not include among his American heroes, Eleanor Roosevelt, whose 131st birthday was this past Sunday, October 11th. She was born in 1884. It appears that Dorothy Day and Eleanor Roosevelt never met, but they certainly knew of each other and most likely had many of the same friends among political activists of the time. They worked in very separate spheres, religious and secular, but had very much in common. Both were born in the late 19th century, Eleanor Roosevelt in 1884 and Dorothy Day in 1897, November 8th, my sister's birthday exactly half a century later. Both were raised in comfortable circumstances, Eleanor Roosevelt considerably more so, and both came into public prominence during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Mrs. Roosevelt as her husband and cousin, FDR's activist first lady during his four terms as president, almost four terms, Dorothy Day as leading light, and that's in quotes, of the Catholic Worker, its first issue published May 1st, 1933, 2 months after the Roosevelts, plural, first inauguration. Both women were damned by conservatives as subversives. In Dorothy Day's case, intensively scrutinized by the FBI and often arrested, and Eleanor Roosevelt was severely lacerated by racists of her own party for championing civil rights for women and blacks, and, much worse in their opinion, for being friends with black women and men and inviting them to the White House. Both also continued to have active public careers well into the post-war decades. Eleanor Roosevelt passionately, patiently, and resolutely chaired the United Nations committee that drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, if for no other reason she deserves the acclamation and esteem of humanity, the rest of its history. Dorothy Day worked for the rest of her life for such social causes as universal pacifism, suffrage for the poor, and for women's rights, and she opened her home, wherever she lived, to homeless and destitute friends and strangers. Sort of ironically, they had a chance to meet when Eleanor Roosevelt made one of her regular visits to the New York Women's House of Detention in New York City in 1957. Dorothy Day happened to be there, serving one of her usual short visits as a prisoner, this instance for protesting a civil defense drill. But except for a tart exchange of letters about civil defense, they never had the chance to personally take measure of each other, which is probably a palpable loss to history and humanity. The former First Lady, an ardent pacifist, was an advocate of civil defense, which she considered protection of the masses from the horrors of war, influenced by her experiences of World War II and the post-war nuclear arms race. Dorothy Day, no less a pacifist, was not. Considering the promotion of even the remotest possibility of surviving nuclear attack as advocacy for nuclear war. Eleanor Roosevelt died on November 7, 1962, at age 78, a day earlier and 65 years after Dorothy Day's birth. And Dorothy Day died November 29, 1980, age 83 and 11 days. Now I would like to read something that Dorothy Day wrote in April 1953. A question of comfort. Poverty is a strange and elusive thing. I have tried to write about it, its joys and its sorrows, for 20 years now. I could probably write about it for another 20 years without conveying what I feel about it as well as I would like. I condemn poverty, and I advocate it. Poverty is simple and complex at once. It is a social phenomenon and a personal matter. It is a paradox. St. Francis was the little poor man, and none was more joyful than he. Yet Francis began with tears, with fear and trembling, hiding in a cave from his irate father. He had expropriated some of his father's goods, which he considered his rightful inheritance, in order to repair a church and rectory where he meant to live. It was only later that he came to love Lady Poverty. He took it little by little. It seemed to grow on him. Perhaps kissing the leper was the great step that freed him, not only from fastidiousness and a fear of disease, but from attachment from worldly goods as well. Sometimes it takes but one step. We would like to think so. And yet the older I get, the more I see that life is made up of many steps, and they are very small affairs, not giant strides. I have kissed a leper, not once but twice, consciously, and I cannot say I am much the better for it. The first time was early one morning on the steps of Precious Blood Church. A woman with cancer of the face was begging. Beggars are allowed only in the slums. And when I gave her money, no sacrifice on my part, but merely passing on alms, which someone had given me, she tried to kiss my hand. The only thing I could do was kiss her dirty old face with the gaping hole in it, where an eye and nose had been. It sounds like a heroic deed, but it was not. One gets used to ugliness so quickly. What we aver our eyes from one day is easily born the next when we have learned a little more about love. Nurses know this, and so do mothers. Another time I was refusing a bed to a drunken prostitute with a huge, toothless, rouged mouth a nightmare of a mouth. She had been raising a disturbance in the house. I kept remembering how St. Teresa said that when you had to refuse anyone anything, you could at least do it so the person went away a bit happier. I had to deny her a bed, but when that woman asked me to kiss her, I did, and it was a loathsome thing, the way she did it. It was scarcely a mark of normal human affection. We suffer these things, and they fade from memory. But daily, hourly, to give up our possessions, and especially to subordinate our own impulses and wishes to others, these are hard, hard things, and I don't think they get any easier. You can strip yourself, you can be stripped, but still you will reach out like an octopus to seek your own comfort, your untroubled time, your ease, your refreshment. It may mean books or music, the gratification of the inner senses, or it may mean food and drink, coffee and cigarettes. The one kind of giving up is not easier than the other. How does property fit in? People ask. It was artist Eric Gill who said that property is proper to man, and St. Thomas Aquinas said that a certain amount of goods is necessary to lead a good life. Recent popes have written at length that justice rather than charity should be sought for the worker. Unions are still fighting for better wages and hours, and it is a futile fight with the price of living going up steadily. They are fighting for partial gains, and every strike means sacrifice to them, and still the situation in the long run is not better. There may be talk of better standards of living, of every worker with his car and owning his own home, but still his comfort depends on a wage, a boss, a war. Our whole modern economy is based on preparations for a war, and that is one of the great modern arguments for poverty. If the comfort one has gained has resulted in the death of thousands in Korea, the Korean War was still going on at the time, and other parts of the world, then that comfort will have to be atoned for. The argument now is that there is no civilian population, that all are involved in the war, misnamed defense effort. If you work in a textile mill making cloth or in a factory making dungarees or blankets, your work is still tied up with war. If you raise food or irrigate the land to raise food, you may be feeding troops or liberating others to serve as troops. If you ride a bus, you are paying taxes. Whatever you buy is taxed, so that you are, in effect, helping to support the state's preparations for a war exactly to the extent of your attachment to worldly things of whatever kind. The merchant counting his profit in pennies, the millionaire with his efficiency experts, have learned how to amass wealth by following their example and profiting by the war boom. There is no necessity for anyone to be poor nowadays, so they say. But the fact remains that every house of hospitality is full. There is a bread line outside our door every day, twice a day, 200 or 300 strong. Families write us pitifully for help. This is not poverty. This is destitution. In front of me as I write is illustrator Fritz Eichenberg's picture of St. Vincent de Paul. He holds a chubby child in his arms, and a thin, pale child is clinging to him. Yes, the poor are always going to be with us. Our Lord told us that. And there will always be a need for our sharing, for stripping ourselves to help others. It will always be a lifetime job. But I am sure that God did not intend that there be so many poor. The class structure is of our making and by our consent, not his, and we must do what we can to change it. So we are urging revolutionary change. So many sins against the poor cry out to high heaven. One of the most deadly sins is to deprive the laborer of his hire. There is another, to instill in him the paltry desires so compulsive that he is willing to sell his liberty and his honor to satisfy them. We are all guilty of concupiscence. But newspapers, radios, television, and battalions of advertising men, woe to that generation, deliberately stimulate our desires, the satisfaction of which so often means the degradation of the family. Because of these factors of modern life, the only way we can write about poverty is in terms of ourselves, our own personal responsibility. The message we have been given is the cross. We have seen the depths of the faithlessness and stubbornness of the human soul. We are surrounded by skin and failure, and it is a mark of our faith in Christ that we continue to hope, to write, to appeal, and beg for help for our work. And we pray also for an increase in the love of poverty, which goes with love for our brothers and sisters. And that was Dorothy Day. I'd like to finish off this program with something I had only planned for just a moment, because I planned to wish a happy birthday today to Trong Kim An, Aka Monique, an old friend and ally in the wars against war, especially Vietnam. I looked her up on the internet and was startled to discover her brother David, equally a favorite comrade against that genocidal war in their country, had died last year. What I'm about to read in sorrowful memoriam is a medley of obituaries by Paul Vitello of the New York Times and Emily Langer of the Washington Post, with seasoning from my own poignant memories of David and Monique from more than 40 years ago when I was a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and they, brother and sister, fought passionately for both their father and their bitterly divided country. David Trung, a Vietnamese anti-war activist whose conviction on espionage charges in the United States in 1978 raised alarms about the federal government's use of wiretaps without court orders and spurred passage of the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act prohibiting such practices, died on June 26, 2014 in Penang, Malaysia at the age of 68. The cause of his death was a rare form of cancer, said his sister Monique Trung Miller, who is a lawyer in Los Angeles. The prosecution of David and a co-defendant, Ronald L. Humphrey, a U.S. Information Agency officer who served in Vietnam, was the only espionage case to come to trial in connection with the Vietnam War. The two were charged with a conspiracy to injure the nation's defense, quote-unquote, an offense punishable by life in prison. The case, which began after the war had ended, set off a battle between Congress and the White House over the limits of presidential power. David and Ronald Humphrey were sentenced to 15-year prison terms after a jury trial for what the government called a plot to pass sensitive State Department documents to Vietnamese diplomats in Paris. Both served 5 years before being released. Though Humphrey admitted taking the documents and David admitted passing them on, they denied having been spies or having intended to harm the United States. Both said that they had hoped to accelerate the normalization of relations between the United States and Vietnam following the war. Independent intelligence sources said the documents were low-key diplomatic cables, though some were classified as secret. David said that he and Humphrey described the documents as hardly more than diplomatic chit-chat. I'm nobody's agent and nobody's spy, David said to reporters at the time of his trial. The case revealed a tangle of personal, political, and diplomatic complications involving the lives of Vietnamese and Americans in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. More troubling for legal experts and civil liberties groups, however, were revelations about how the government conducted its investigation. No court warrants had been sought by the FBI agents who had tapped David's phone and placed a secret microphone in his apartment and hidden cameras in Humphrey's office during the two-year inquiry. Critics of those tactics saw them as a violation of Fourth Amendment protections against illegal search and seizure. Attorney General Griffin Bell and President Jimmy Carter, who had authorized elements of the surveillance, said their actions were permissible under exceptions to Fourth Amendment protections, historically cited by presidents in matters of national security. President Richard Nixon had cited those exceptions in defending his authorization not only for wiretapping, but also for burglaries in the Watergate affair. In the Trung and Humphrey case, the federal courts stood behind the executive branch. Appeals brought by defense lawyers claiming the evidence against them was illegally obtained were denied. Their appeals, drawn out over 3 years, challenged the admissibility of the evidence collected from the electronic surveillance because it was conducted without a warrant. An appeals court upheld the conviction, arguing that, quote, the needs of the executive are so compelling in the area of foreign intelligence, unlike the area of domestic security, that a uniform warrant requirement would unduly frustrate the president in carrying out his foreign affairs responsibilities, unquote. David began his prison sentence in 1982 and was paroled in 1986. The court's stance galvanized civil libertarians in their campaign for changes in the law. Senator Edward Kennedy, a prime sponsor of the 1978 intelligence surveillance law, said, the recent prosecution against Humphrey and Trung points out the need for this legislation. serious constitutional issues are raised by the case, he said. The law created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a panel of federal judges known as the FISA Court, F-I-S-A. It mandated that one of those judges may review any future requests by the executive branch to employ such techniques in cases concerning national security. After the terrorist attacks of 9/11/2001, several laws were passed at the behest of the George W. Bush administration to widen the president's ability to bypass the legal system when conducting wiretaps. David and his wife, Carolyn Gates, an American economist, left the United States in the 1980s to live in the Netherlands, where both worked as economic development consultants to the European Commission, the executive branch of the European Union. David was born Trung Dinh Hung in Saigon on September 2, 1945, the very day Japan officially surrendered aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Harbor, ending World War II 70 years ago. He was the oldest son of Vo Ti Kim Wong and Trung Dinh Zu, who was a prominent lawyer and politician and also president for a time in the 1950s of the Southeast Asia Rotary Club. Besides his sister Monique, who was born Trung Kim An today, a few years later, and his wife, David is survived by a brother and several half-siblings. David first came to the United States in 1965 as a student and earned degrees in political science and economics at Stanford University. His family discouraged him from returning home because his father had been jailed by Saigon's American-backed government after he unsuccessfully campaigned for the presidency of South Vietnam in 1967. Trung Dinh Zu supported negotiating with the Viet Cong and with North Vietnam. He ran against Nguyen Van Thieu and his running mate, Nguyen Cao Ky, who were the latest leaders of the incumbent military junta that overthrew and assassinated Ngo Dinh Diem in 1963, less than a month before John Kennedy's assassination in Dallas. Diem had been installed in Saigon by the U.S. when Vietnam was to be temporarily divided at the 17th parallel after the French were defeated by Vietnamese insurgents at Dien Bien Phu in 1954 and lost their seven-year war to reclaim their former Southeast Asia colonies after World War II. The subsequent treaty mandated elections to reunify the country in 1956, but the United States attempted to make Diem's regime in the South permanent. David and his sister Monique, who was attending UCLA, became outspoken anti-war activists in the U.S. after their father's arrest. They appealed to Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was campaigning for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. presidency in 1968 on an anti-war platform, to intervene with both the Johnson administration and the Saigon government to release their father from a five-year sentence at the infamous Khong Son Island prison, known as the Devil's Island of Southeast Asia. Dubbed by American sympathizers as the McCarthy of Vietnam, the elder Trung served only five months as a result of intense international pressure for his release. His son David emerged as a compelling leader of the anti-war movement in the United States following his father's arrest. Columnist Drew Pearson wrote that of the several million youngsters in this country urging peace in Vietnam, probably the most effective is David Trung. A Vietnamese who has any feeling for his country cannot help but feel we all struggle together, David told the Washington Post at his trial in 1978. You cannot help but respect your compatriots who have sacrificed more than anybody to keep your country independent and free. David was arrested on January 31, 1978. He was doing postgraduate work at American University at the time and working as a lobbyist in Washington for several organizations advocating normalization of diplomatic ties between the United States and Vietnam, which had reunified under communist rule after South Vietnam's collapse in 1975. He was known and respected on Capitol Hill as a source of information about events in Vietnam following the end of the war and became engaged in an initiative to provide books, documents, and other materials to Vietnamese officials, and through these activities became entangled with a double agent who worked for both the CIA and the FBI. Basing their allegations on wiretaps and the testimony of the double agent, Justice Department prosecutors said David had been passing secret State Department cables about Vietnam-related foreign policy strategies to Vietnamese agents in Paris. Diplomats from the two countries were in negotiations there over an accounting of American prisoners of war and soldiers missing in action, as well as other matters left unresolved at the end of the war. Ronald Humphrey, who had been involved in efforts to get his Vietnamese common law wife and their children out of Vietnam since the fall of Saigon, renamed Ho Chi Minh City, admitted taking the documents. David, who had been trying to help members of his own family come to the United States, admitted passing the documents to Vietnamese citizens in Paris, but he said he believed that they were editors of a Vietnamese newspaper in Paris, not diplomats. In a 2003 memoir, Fighting Injustice, Michael E. Tiger, who represented David at his trial, described the prosecution as part of a political backlash against opponents of the war. Unrepentant for its errors in Vietnam, Tiger wrote, the U.S. government turned against those who had opposed its policies. Rather than opening debate about matters affecting national security, it invoked draconian laws to maintain the wall of secrecy. David's sister Monique said in a phone interview after his death that her brother took a more pragmatic view of the case. He saw it as a political case, she said, and himself as a very small piece in the game that countries play when they want to achieve their political goals. In that game, she added, David understood that we are all expendable. Ironically, after the fall of Saigon and the reunification of Vietnam in 1975, their father, Trung Dinh Du, was sent to a re-education camp by the victorious communists. He apparently died at the age of 98 in Vietnam. My most vivid memory of being with David was as his witness to occupation of the Saigon consulate in San Francisco by Vietnamese AID-sponsored students in conjunction with the simultaneous occupation of the South Vietnamese embassy in Washington, D.C. by another group of young anti-war Vietnamese students in the spring of 1972. The men were dressed formally in suits and the women in beautiful white owl dyes. We were not disturbed by consulate staff, although a contingent of very large and muscular San Francisco cops with very big clubs surrounded us the entire day. When the consulate closed in the late afternoon, the diminutive Vietnamese marched out between the burly cops, lined up in a narrow corridor, bravely singing the famous Internationale in Vietnamese. All these 43 years later, I continue to feel privileged to have been with them that day. Tragically, one of the Vietnamese students hijacked a jet airliner to Vietnam a few days later and was shot and killed by the pilot after the plane landed at Tan Sanut Airport in Saigon. I wish happy birthday to Monique today and express my sorrowful surprise that her brother and my long time ago friend, David, is dead. This has been Michael McCusker, and don't forget, in 15 minutes, to drop, cover, and hold on for the Great Oregon Shakeout.